This is the, do you call it the altar picture in America? In a church, you have an altar picture showing something holy, something brilliant, something nice you want to show about the gospel. Altarpiece, yes. So this is Sweden's altarpiece. This is lax, the plant, collected from all 25 provinces in Sweden. And it's woven into 200 shades of gray. That is the altarpiece of Sweden, the most liberated, the most autonomous and free and individualistic nation on earth. And here's what I wanted to show, where an old man and a little girl looking at and pondering, what became of all this? How do we evaluate this? And the title of the popularized version, you know, I have a more complicated academic title to the dissertation, but the popularized version is called The Nation That Forgot God. In Sweden, we have an expression, the house that God forgot, the this and that that God forgot. So I turn it around and make us think about how Sweden, through these political processes and cultural processes, came to forget its creator and what this did to our nation. So this is the project that I've been working with for the last couple of years. And here is where you find me on social media and so on. So the title, the headline of today's speech is How Secular Individualism Took Over the West, with Sweden as a particular example, and how the church can respond. And some of us work in church, some of you may be pastors or working in churches, and all of us are members in a church, in a local congregation, and we're members of the worldwide church. And the worldwide church got a mission from the Lord 2,000 years ago, and that's the mission that we work with and walk in today as well. So each period, each culture has its challenges, and this is our particular challenge, the secular individualism in the West that we live in. So let us begin then with the map, the global map. I guess that a lot of you have seen this. This is the Ingolhart Wetzel map of the world, where you see the nations in the world in different clusters. You see the Islamic nations here, the African Islamic nations here. A lot of survival group values, a lot of traditional religious values. And the higher up you go on the scale, the more secular a nation becomes, the values in it. And the more rightward you go, the more individualistic. And here you see, of course, where we are. We are in a Catholic nation right now, Poland, but a lot of us come from Protestant Europe. And you see, we are up there in the top right-hand corner as very individualistic and very secular. And if you look in the top right-hand position, you see one particular nation, and I happen to live in it. So that's why I wanted to investigate what happened in Sweden. What turned Sweden into this very secular and very individualistic culture that we are in Sweden, and that also characterizes a lot of other nations, especially in Protestant Europe. We share the same heritage with Luther, and we a good heritage with Scripture alone and Christ alone, but that also seems to have some kind of tendency that may be overly individualistic and getting rid of the alone that Luther communicated. So I'm going to talk about some basic features that are equal to several cultures and several nations, and then go into the historic Swedish example, and then end up in a few pieces of advice to me as a Swede and to all of us as Europeans or living in the Western world. So the model that I've used in my scholarly work, I think it's a good description of the values that are central in this secular individualistic culture, which is autonomy as the center of everything. I don't know if you've done a word study of the word autonomy. It is Greek, as a lot of words that we use. Autonomia, that is self-law. Man and woman making their own laws instead of the law given by God, by tradition, by, natural law theory and so on. But man, humans, creating their own law, and that's the autonomous project, that sort of, That's always part of individualism. There are different versions of individualism in different nations, and I'll show you some example later. But autonomy is always a part of individualism, even though there are the individualisms that are not so autonomous-centered. But secularism and individualism tend to go hand in hand. There are cultures that are more individualistic but less secular, and some countries that are very secular and not so individualistic. But quite often, they tend to merge. And it seems that the autonomous project typically rebels against three opposing values, three opposing factors. And I've seen this very clearly in the political history in Sweden that I've studied. And it's common, I think, in a lot of cultures where the autonomous project is propagated. You tend to rebel against community. And obviously the family is the most usual, the strongest, the most natural community there is. So the autonomous project has a tendency to confront community in the family and in other ways as a threat to the independence of the individual. It also tends to rebel against authority in all forms. Authority in form of scripture, in form of tradition, in form of moral laws or traditions or norms, and also against nature itself, because nature can pose an authority that threatens the independence of the individual. And in that case, nature itself could be an authority to confront. And also, this opposition very often tends to be directed against the sacred, if we use that as a large phrase. That includes God, that includes scripture, that includes church tradition. That would, of course, include other religions as well. But in our part of the world, it's very clear that it opposes the Christian worldview and the Christian traditions and scripture, and, of course, God himself. So that is a summary I find helpful in understanding what is at stake, what values are actually propagated in our culture. And I summarize this by the final end of this project, which I call ultra-progressivism. You have a general progressivism that is present in a lot of communities and have been over time, but the very utopia of this I call ultra-progressivism, which is the striving for an autonomous liberation from all factors reflecting some kind of authority. And where there are different values at stake, different interests to consider in politics, in church, and in other areas, this utopian striving always trumps all other values and practical challenge. That is the ultra-progressivism, where the struggle for autonomy rises above all others. It becomes the most important of all commandments, compared to what we heard in the Bible study this morning, where Jesus and the lawyer discussed what are the two most important commandments. And Jesus talks about loving God, loving your neighbor, which opposes the autonomous project, because the autonomous project deals with me and the auto. So with this then as a foundation, I think that this is a valuable model in order to understand what is going on in the struggle between values in different communities and different cultures. So if we take the example of church then, and focus on church this workshop, and we can focus on other areas in other places and networks, there is a study done by a scholar named Philip Hammond. He conducted a study in four different U.S. states, very different U.S. states. I think there were Massachusetts, North Carolina, Ohio, and California. And he investigated different denominations, different churches, and saw, is there a connection of how much you propagate personal autonomy? And how does this reflect into church participants? And different ways of participating in church and living your life as a Christian. And he answers his own rhetorical question. This is a summary of his book. He studied four different states, a lot of different denominations, but does personal autonomy translate everywhere into lower parish involvement? The answer is yes. So his point of view is that churches who preach, propagate, live out autonomy as the basic virtue that the individual should stand free from things that capture them. You know, the things that are raised in popular debate and in internal church debates. If this is propagated, it always leads to lower parish involvement. That's a clear conclusion. And I'd like to give you, I'm going to give you an example from Sweden. We've had a large debate in Sweden, in Swedish free churches, the one that took part in the former state church a decade or two decades ago. And it happened to be, in our time, about sexuality and gender. Could be about something else. And that's the thing about the autonomous project, that there are different issues at stake in each time and each culture. In our time and in Europe, it tends to be about sexuality and gender. Could be about something else, but it is. And the largest church in one of the liberal denomination in Sweden, there was a debate about that some months ago, where some international members who came from other nations than Sweden, they protested and said that we've figured out now that we've become members in this church, you become very, very woke here and more interested in, promoting the individualistic and woke lifestyle and values. We don't feel at home here. How could we live together in this kind of church? And in the best of worlds, people with different opinions in several questions could live together and work together for the Lord in the same church. But here is how the church leadership replied. And I think that this is very clear. I'm going to give it to you in Swedish, but I'm going to translate it to you. When autonomous values become a basis for an intolerant tolerance. Tolerance is a value that is propagated in the progressive movement, obviously. But when put in practice, it actually becomes intolerant. And it did so very clearly in this case, because the church leadership stated a few months ago in an open article, saying that everyone that is elected or a volunteer leader or an employee in this church must accept and promote this view which is progressive, liberal, whichever way you would like to describe it, or autonomous, but a foundation which is not based on scripture or on authority in a Christian sense, but on the autonomous project. If you think that way, you're not welcome in our church. So that was very, very clear, and I think this is where the direction should probably be going in all churches that follow this direction. Tolerance is promoted, but in the end, it isn't practiced. And to connect with Hammond's conclusion that if you run this project, the view is that you need to adapt to the popular culture to attract people and feel that you are an open-minded church, come to us. Does that lead to more people coming to church? No, it doesn't, because I saw just yesterday a newspaper article in a Christian newspaper in Sweden saying the opposite, that Hammond is correct. They had just received the statistics for this denomination. There are a number of denominations in Sweden, like I guess there are in your nations, and basically they tend to group into conservative, Bible-based evangelical denominations and liberal denominations. And the largest of the liberal denominations, well, they actually merged into one denomination some 10 years ago. And each year, they lose members. And the news was yesterday, the trend continues. This church falls in membership. And it does every year. And I read interviews with people involved in that denomination. And they did all they could to give a positive view of what was happening. Because the trend is very, very clear. It's falling each year. And one of them actually answered, well, statistics aren't important. Well, you could say that if it's falling, but you would be very fond of statistics if the numbers were going up. But this is very, very clear. Hammond is correct. A liberal, a progressive church doesn't attract converts. That's a general picture. So with this as some kind of foundation then, we could go into some different types of cultures. You can relate to the different factors in society in different ways, and these are just very schematic examples. You have a state, you have a family, and here you can involve church and other communities, and you have the individual. In a culture such as the German, as said, this is a schematic view. It's not perfect. It's more complex than that. But typically, in Germany, the family and the state could connect together, and the individual would fall somewhere more in the background. While in the United States, the family, the church, and so on, would connect to the individual. The individual has a natural place in community with others, and they sort of make a distance towards the state. The state is dangerous in American tradition. While in the Swedish example, we have what we call the Swedish state individualism, where the individual can't live by himself. It's impossible. We will run into anarchy and chaos. The individual has to connect to some factor, some part in society. So here, the individual connects to the state, and the state guarantees that the individual autonomy is secured and guaranteed. This is the picture is obviously more complex in the real world, but this is an easy way of understanding the typical versions and the different cultures. So Sweden, a background then. I'm going to give you quite a background, not an enormous background, but what you need to understand a bit of. I've been studying political history, the period when the Social Democrats ruled Sweden, governed Sweden for 45 uninterrupted years. That's an enormous long time for one party to control a nation. And if you are a devoted political party, you can do very much in such a long time. And they did. But I'm comparing also with the non-socialist parties to look at what could have happened to Sweden if other parties would have been government in Sweden during this time. There are three non-socialist parties in Sweden. The Liberals, who tend to be in between the Social Democrats and the other more conservative parties, they said during most of their history that Christian culture and humanist way of life is an unalienable foundation for a good society. They mention the Christian worldview alongside with the humanist worldview, but they think the Christian worldview is necessary in a good society. The other two parties in Sweden is the agrarians, now called the Centre Party, but was a traditional farmers' party. And they said from the 1930s and 40s and 50s that Christian faith and view of life must be promoted and kept as a foundation for the upbringing of the Swedish people. That's very clear where they stand and what basis they found good for community and for the nation. And the conservatives, now called the moderates, which is a fun name for a party, they said that from the 1950s, established that the Swedish people is by tradition a, in italics, Christian people, and that the Christian faith is an indispensable supporting and purifying power in society. That's pretty clear. And 8 years after that, they founded the Christian Democrats. But that shouldn't really have been necessary if there was a party that was actively promoting this worldview. But over time, as Swedish society changed in a more secular direction, an individualistic direction, the other parties had to decide, should we stand in opposition and keep our line, or do we follow along with the train that has left the station? So they followed along. Because there was another party that were completely dominating the Swedish picture. We've had three prime ministers during these years, and two of them actually died while in office, the first and the last. The first one, Per Albin Hansson, he grew up as a Marxist, worked as a Marxist, and promoted his views as a Marxist, like most social democrats did at that time before they became more pragmatic, like in our time. But he felt it was perfectly normal to avoid Christianity because we are socialists and there are the Christians. We are not those. The next one, Tage Erlander, who is the longest serving Swedish prime minister, 23 years, he grew up as an active believer. But during his time in university, he left his old group. And when he was finished there, he was into a new group and had completely left his old group. He was rather traditional in his moral views still, but he found religion very uninteresting when he had left it. And finally, Olof Palme grew up as an upper class and then changed to the working class, to the socialist group, and he considered religion to be completely uninteresting, which is strange because he was the large minister of ecclesiastical affairs in Sweden, combination of church and school. But when asked and when pressed on issues of church and religion, he was very, very contempt and dislike. That was his feelings that he showed against us. This is absolutely unnecessary in today's modern society. So these are the leaders of the party, but I'm going to show you a little bit more people, because there are more people involved, usually, than prime ministers in changing a nation. And I'm going to show you a few politicians and a few other people, just to give you an example. I don't know about your nations, but these are the people that were most influential in changing Sweden. First we have Arthur Engberg, a really devoted atheist. And he's very clear about that in his younger years. He very much dislikes Christianity and the church. His opponent or friend in the party is called Harald Hallén. And as you can see from his clothing, he should be more positive towards the church than he was, because he was a clergyman. But both of them, they were very clear that the church should not be controlled by scripture, tradition, priests and bishops. It should be controlled by democratic means. And as we belong to the Social Democratic Party, it should be controlled by our ideals, our party ideals. And they were very, very successful in taking the power away from the church authorities into secular political authorities. And Sweden is actually still the only nation in the world, I think, where the church is ruled by political parties, which it still is. If we move to another field, we have school, which is a very important area in society if you want to secularize a society. Here is Alva Myrdal, who may be the most influential person in Swedish 20th century history, because she was active both in religious areas. She tried to become a Christian while 15 years old, but she never succeeded, and then she became an enemy of the Christian faith. She's also very much involved in pedagogy and reforming the school into a very much progressive pedagogy. And she's also involved in family policy and saying that the family is trapping the individual, and you need to break free of all these bonds, and then people will become free. And alongside her was Stellan Arvidsson, a former headmaster who became the secretary in the Swedish School Commission of 1946, who built the new school, the secularized school, the hyper-individualized school. He was also a long time chairman of the Sweden-East Germany Friendship Association, and he found the East German system the perfect one for Sweden. And I'm going to show you an example later. So these two are school people. Here, if you're a philosopher, you may know this gentleman, who was a professor in philosophy in early 1900s. His name is Axel Hägerström, very influential in Sweden and in other nations. Proclaiming that there are no actual values. There is no good and evil, no right or wrong. There is just feelings about it, value nihilistic philosophy. It was very influential, for instance, for Engberg in teaching him how society should be built and why God is not necessary, why values are not necessary. And alongside him, we have another philosopher called Ingmar Hedenius, who wrote a book in 1949 called Faith and Knowledge, where he challenged Christianity, basically saying, if you say that you have a rational faith to build on, present it and defend it, and I can say I don't find it rational. But very, very unfortunately, Sweden didn't have an apologetic network at the ELF. So there were no strong apologists in Sweden to defend the faith, and Hedenius won that battle. It's called the Hedenius battle during the 1950s, where people got the impression that, well, nobody says that Christianity is a valid worldview to build upon. It's just a tradition. It's just a faith. So let's keep the Hedenius then and say that atheism is the new version to follow. And from the cultural sphere also, I think some of you noticed this gentleman, Ingmar Bergman, Sweden's most famous filmmaker ever, who was very, very angry with his father, who was a clergyman, and very, very angry at our Father who is in heaven. He writes in his memoir how he hates God, he hates Jesus, and the blood, and the communion, and the way Jesus speaks, and so on. He's very clear about it. So if you have a nation with such strong, devoted people at central positions in church, who are very devoted to bringing away the traditional authority of scripture and Christian tradition and introducing a new autonomous culture. If you have the same people in school that are very devoted to reform the school and remove the traditional authority of the teacher and of knowledge itself. The new school in Sweden became very much more political, with political goals rather than knowledge goals. If you have philosophers, usually change in a nation begins in philosophy and the academy, and then you can plant it in new generations. And they won the battle. And if you also have culture. So if you have all these people who are influential and leading in their fields, and they are very devoted to a secular individualistic worldview, you will have a large influence in your nation. So that's the example of Sweden. And you can ponder and evaluate what has it been like in your nation, which people have been influential, how have they influenced the society and the nation you come from. And to sum up, there were three crucial battlefields in Sweden, and I didn't know exactly where they were before I started this study. I imagined that school would be important. But as it turned out, in the social democratic internal debates and the documents that they presented, how are we going to change society? These three fields are the most important, and they appear in this very order too. And there seems to be some kind of logic with it. Because if you begin with a church, and if you can control the church with new ideals that are autonomous, built on secular and individualistic ideals, you don't have a prophetic opposition anymore, and you can continue to do whatever you like. And that worked out efficiently, very efficiently in Sweden. So if you take over the church, which policy managed to do around 1950 or so, with the effects turning out in the late 1950s and so on, you can go on to the school. And that was the second battlefield, where there was a huge debate in Sweden in 1963. That was the largest popular petition in Swedish history. 2.1 million people signed a petition to keep the teaching of Christianity in school. That was 42% of those eligible to vote in Sweden. There was enormous expression of opinion, and the government didn't care about it and went on with their plan and hoped that people would accept it, and they did. And the church did, because the church had largely been taken off their weapons. And if you can control the church, if you can control the school, it's very natural to take the next step, which is the family. So that was the project in the late 1960s and early 1970s, where Sweden began in the most radical family political experiment in the world. And that could be done because the former authorities were taken away. And they actually say that in a government report from 1972 about family and marriage. They say that earlier on, in earlier generations, religion was an important part in families in Sweden. It isn't anymore, because we've changed the way we view family, we've changed the way we view religion in society. So therefore, religion now is now only a part in the most pious families. So these were the three main battlefields in Sweden. They could have been performed in another order, and maybe they were or are in your nations, but they were conducted in this particular order, in the particular example of Sweden, which is the world's most secular individualistic nation. So those that want to be like Sweden, they can learn from the Swedish example, and those that don't want to end up like Sweden can think, maybe you ought to do otherwise. And just to show how the mission was accomplished, you see the gentleman here, Stellan Arvidsson, he's still going strong, but he's thrown out from his party because he could not criticize the last time Russia invaded a foreign nation, when they invaded Czechoslovakia. He couldn't criticize the Soviet Union because they were good. So the Social Democrats threw him out. But then he stood at the peak of his career, and he received the honorary doctorate at the University of Rostock in East Germany. And that's his friend, Paul Wandel, the first Minister of Education in East Germany, and they're very, very proud. And he says in his speech there, those of you who understand German, that, well, he says one thing here, which is very telling in the middle. The historians must in the future explain how a socialist school reform could be undertaken in a capitalist nation. And nobody had done that before, so I undertook that task to try to give that description. But he's very clear in explaining, both before and towards the end, that diese ist ein Mittel, die schwedische Gesellschaft zu demokratisieren, das heißt den Sozialismus vorzubereiten. What we are doing by reforming the Swedish school system is to prepare for socialism. He's very, very clear, and the East German people are very satisfied with it. So, to wrap up, there are some questions. Was it historically necessary that Sweden and other nations need to go in this direction? Or are they the result of specific factors? And I would say, based on other scholarly theory and on empiry, what happened in Sweden and elsewhere, I would say the latter. It was a result of specific factors. And then the next question comes, what about the future? Where would the future end up in Sweden and in your nations or in the world? Well, it comes down to what we do. Actually, it does. The Jesus followers were 12 and they got rid of one, so then there were 11. And they managed to do quite a lot. They managed to start the largest popular movement on earth. These people, they changed Sweden into a particular direction. And nations could go another direction, could have gone another direction, and could go another direction in the future. So some takeaways then, both that secularism and individualism, sometimes they can go different ways, but they tend to be intertwined. That is, and scholars would agree with me, there is a scholar named Steve Bruce, sociologist, who believes that if a nation modernizes, it necessarily becomes more secular. But he says that if autonomy is propagated, that is the basic value that drives everything. If autonomy is propagated, secularization will continue forever, if that is the value that is the most central in a culture. And secondly, if you are in a culture where there is strong criticism against authority as such, we too may criticize bad authorities that are destructive in a number of ways, and we ought to do so. But cultures that criticize authority per se, they tend in the long term to roll over into autonomy. And then eventually, if you don't put a stop to it, they will roll over into what I call ultra-progressivism, which is the example that we saw in Sweden in early 1970s and that we see actually in a lot of cultures today, also in parts of America. The ultra-progressive movement is really, really strong. And that rolls on if it doesn't meet opposition. And thirdly then, values or cultures that oppose community, like the community that we share here, that we share at home with our families, community that is based on, I'm not the center of everything, but our relation is, you are somebody that I love. Or an opposition to authority as such, and an opposition against God, church, Bible, everything connected to the sacred, that leads to secularization. But on the other hand, if we make a sound defense of these, we all know that there are destructive communities, there are destructive families, there are destructive congregations and so on. But if we promote and defend good community, loving communities, and the same thing with authorities, good, stable authorities, reliable authorities, humble authorities that are sound and that are based on truth, and of course of the sacred, a God who was and is to come, and is all-loving, all-powerful. If we defend and express this would diminish secularization. So wherever you are, if you are working in a church or if you're in a regular workplace or wherever you are in society, try to figure what ideas are actually propagated here, what basic values are propagated, because things tend to come up in debates, and they're often about secondary questions, and the people propagating them may be very devoted to them and say that this is really, really important. But if you figure that this is actually about promoting autonomy, the individual independence as a basic virtue, make sure you find it and make sure that if this needs to be battled, do so. Because, as I said, there may be some question that the debate seems to be on. Should our church be welcoming to different people? Yes, that sounds very good. Sounds really good. But does this phrase hide an autonomous worldview? In that case, we need to understand what is actually about, what is the battle about? And if you meet people who follow this liberal or progressive or autonomous worldview, the end goal is always the complete transfer of authority to the individual. Always. And if this has been transferred a lot, the only goal is to transfer it more. Because that is the only goal that you can have in the autonomous worldview if you follow the snake in the garden who says that, get rid of God. He doesn't liberate you. You decide for yourself what is right and wrong. Then you will be free. And if you don't feel free now, do so a little bit more, and then you will be free. And there are people in secular society who are not believing Christians, who are not members of church, who also share the same frustration about this woke or autonomous progressive culture, who see that there is something that we've lost in our society. And that's what I try to point out with a cover of the book, people standing and thinking about what actually happened to our society. Has we become the liberated, all happy society that we long for? Or is there something that we've forgotten? And there are people that we can connect with in different questions. Different people in different questions, secondary questions. And then if we communicate and if we defend a perspective on things, not just focusing on the flames that arise, but focusing what is actually at stake, what is the real thing going on here. And if we defend truth and love, which is the real love that people long for and need, which is the agape love, which isn't about me and people accepting everything that I do or want to do, but loving others for their sake. It's not always openly requested, either in society or perhaps not always in church, but it's very, very much needed, and that's why Jesus came to earth. I just wish to remind you that you saw the people before. There were few individuals, some prime ministers and some other people, very devoted people. It takes few individuals to change a nation, and that has happened before, and it can happen again. And some people may be at the front, some people may be in powerful positions, and some people may inspire others. Everyone can inspire others. And sometimes we're aware that we inspire them, and we really try lobbying people very actively. And sometimes we just inspire people in ways that we don't know. And I got two examples to conclude with. The first is I wrote a school book. And I wrote, for instance, how do you influence society? And we picked a picture of a young girl who travels by train to a UN meeting and trying to influence people. And I included some practical ideas on what you do if you have an idea. For instance, in environment or something else, how do you influence people, politicians and media and so on? So that book was published and it went a number of years. And then a few years ago, there was a little girl who didn't want to go to school. So instead, she took her school books and went to Parliament and sat outside with her school books and began demonstrating. And it's just a lot of time afterwards that I realized when I look at this picture, hey, wait a minute, that's my book. So this isn't about Greta. If you like Greta, that's perfectly okay. And if you don't like her movement, that's okay. But you know who to either thank or blame. Because this little girl, she became the most influential, not in her school, but in the whole world. And I have no idea whether I influenced her a lot or a little. That's not important. But people can influence others. And I'd just like to finish with Engberg, who was so incredibly devoted to de-Christianizing Sweden. He said so, he wrote so in books. My goal is to de-Christianize Sweden. And this is him as an older man, having left his position as Minister of Ecclesiastical Affairs. And he was much influenced when he became part of the revision of the psalm book in Sweden. We had a state church, so we need a state psalm book. So he became very much personally involved in that, and apparently that affected him. So he became less hostile, and towards the end, more positive towards the Christian faith. And early 1944, he wrote a letter to Archbishop, then Archbishop in Sweden, writing then, "My party is on the run now. We have, or they have, taken over control over this local and diocesan level of church policy. Now there is a plan to take over on the general synodal level, on the national level as well. I'd like to meet you to discuss how you can protect the church from this." But this meeting apparently never happened, because a few weeks later, Engberg caught some kind of stomach disease and died. And he was buried in his hometown city at the very center of Sweden, called Hassela. And Hassela is also, there are a lot of paradoxes in this, but in Hassela, in the city where Christianity's largest enemy, who ended his life, says the local priest, by receiving communion and dying as a believer, in this village is also raised Sweden's and one of the world's tallest crosses. That's an amazing paradox. So you see, he was influenced early in his life by the very atheistic philosopher Hägerström, and late in his life he was influenced by hymns. And we don't know what influences people, but everybody can influence others, and that's one of the ideas that I would like to send with you. So Sweden and the West has been very much influenced by secular individualism. This is not granted that it will last forever. Another world is possible.